Today on Life and Faith.
They had no medicine, they had nothing. And I was walking with camel caravans all over Djibouti. And at the last of it, the French reconnaissance fighters came in to take away any territory that the people that I was assisting had got. And so I had to run through horrible desert land with stones all everywhere for over 12 hours with my child, Aisha. She was then nearly two on my back to save my life with the French fighter planes overhead, the ISA army coming behind us. That was a run for literally for my life, yes.
Why are we here? Can I have a relationship with God? These kinds of things I can't measure with my microscope or my telescope.
Hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down.
Christianity isn't some kind of self-help doctrine. It's not probiotics for the soul or something, you know?
He was using the parable of the Good Samaritan to justify bombing Syria.
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, one of the perks of podcasting is you do get to have conversations with a lot of people who are out of the ordinary and who've led very different lives to most of us and to what they expected often. Now, Natasha, talk to me about Valerie Browning.
Yep. I don't quite know how to describe Valerie. She is tiny and she is tough. Everything about her story is a bit overwhelming, actually. She's a nurse by profession. She is from Australia, but she lives in what is probably the hottest inhabited place in the world. Though when I asked her about that, as about a lot of things, she gave kind of a bit of a shrug.
Well, it's a dry heat. It's not like Sydney in humidity. I couldn't live in Sydney's humidity, but I love Afar heat. I've now got woolen things all around me.
You are very rugged up.
I hate the cold. Hot is beautiful. At the moment, it's 45 to 50. It's our hot season, and it's beautiful. It really is. The hot winds are not so beautiful, but other than that, it's pretty good. People die of thirst every year because of not just the heat, but because of the lack of water, the distance between water points.
Valerie lives in the Afar region in the Ethiopian desert. She's lived there for 30 years among the Afar people who are traditionally nomads, herdsmen. So Natasha, how does that happen to someone who was born in England and grew up in Armidale in country New South Wales in Australia?
This is a good question. This was about the first thing I asked her. I'll let her tell her story. It's a bit of an epic one. She, you know, she gets shot at. She nearly dies in childbirth. She gets bitten by a snake. She tells me she has 11 children under seven at home right now.
Oh, gosh.
Not biological children, obviously, presumably. But when I asked in response to some of the more extreme stories of her life, are you never afraid? She was almost taken aback. She was a bit like, no, fear is a useless thing. I think that gives you a sense of how exceptional this woman and her life is. I should say that some of these stories are distressing. I feel like we give that warning at the beginning of more and more episodes these days. But if you're open to having all of your life choices called into question, here we go. Here's Valerie Browning on how she ended up where she is.
The silly thing is, when I was 10 years old, we migrated on a P&O ship to Australia. So we went down the Red Sea past the Afar, past these people I'm living with. And why I didn't jump ship when I was 10 years old, I've got no idea. But anyway, I didn't. I came all the way to Australia with my family, as you said. I went to school in Armidale. Later, I trained at the Royal Alexandra Children's Hospital in Sydney and the Crown Street Women's. I later worked in the Royal Women's in Melbourne. But for the last 30 years, I've been living in the Horn of Africa. I went there first when I was 22. And I went there more or less to help a friend who was, I thought, being very foolish and very gullible to go and join what was then called a Australian medical team to help in the famine in Ethiopia. I thought she was just ridiculous. So I thought, oh, well, big me, I'll protect her. And we would go for 3 months. We ended up staying 6 months. And it, for me, was an enormous life changer.
Did she stay in Africa as well?
No, she didn't. She came back here. She now has a house in Annandale, so she's a good Australian. She's a nurse, a very qualified nurse. She studied a lot, and she became both a clinical teacher as well as a clinician in nursing. And she's now retired. But yeah, I'm the one who couldn't keep myself in one spot, jumped up and down, and eventually went and stayed back there. Yeah.
So what was it about life in Africa, life specifically in this region of Ethiopia, that caught you, that made you want to stay?
As a nurse, obviously, your profession is to save life. It's to help people to get better and to survive sickness. But what I'd seen when I went with my friend Roe into Ethiopia was people die of hunger. I just could not believe that this was possible. So it, more or less, it was the injustice of that, that on the streets of Sydney you could have anything you like, from Mars bars, ice creams, anything. Even way back then, there were, the streets were full of food. They're even more full of food now. But anyway, the whole injustice of how people anywhere should have to go through the abject misery of dying of hunger. I remember one mother who brought me three of her children, one in the midday, that little one died on my knee, and then by sunset she brought another one, that one died, and in the night another died. Three of her children in the space of less than 24 hours died of hunger because she couldn't feed them and I couldn't help them. It was just a horrible, horrible thinking that this should happen. Whose fault? Who had incited the problem? Where did it come from? Those days, that's 73, 74, a long time ago, no social media, and literally, yeah, hardly any media coverage. Obviously Haile Selassie had his foot in the whole problem. But what about the rest of the world? How did they allow it to happen to such an extent? Thousands of people died of hunger, thousands. So with that injustice, I then resolved that I would try all I could to expose injustice, to tell people, to try and find solutions, to work myself if as needed to find that solution. And that's the way I am today, I guess, yeah.
You've lived among the Afar for how many years now?
30.
And do you consider yourself one of them?
I can never consider. No. We are what we are. And I'm as white as they come. I actually don't burn because I've got camel skin almost, but and camel's feet. I am married to an Afar. I'm married to a Muslim man. I'm Christian. I have lots of children. And so in their sense, I'm an Afar mother and I should behave like one. I should be disciplined by them and so on. I speak the language. I follow the culture very as closely as I can. I would never dress, for example, in jeans or trousers because that's, for them, very, very difficult for them to tolerate from their women. I love sitting on the ground with them, fooling around. I walk a lot in the Afar society. Yeah. So, am I Afar? No, I'm not. But what nationality am I? I don't really care. I don't believe in nationality. I really don't. I support Ethiopia, by the way.
Mm.
I'm very strong at supporting Ethiopia because Ethiopia, I think, has been mistreated in the world, naughty world.
Would you tell me about meeting your husband?
Okay.
How you got married?
In the 80s, because there was a communist or the Derg war going on in Ethiopia, I was continually in and out to try and see that the refugees pouring out of Ethiopia had food. This was the first thing they needed. They didn't have food. In Somalia, they were living in huge camps of over 1 million refugees in a camp, no food, no nothing. And so I was working as a freelance journalist with the BBC, British BBC, on a program called Focus on Africa years ago when we worked by telegram, interestingly, banging on an old metal typewriter. And I was totally freelance and totally voluntary. I wasn't paid or contracted to the BBC. They always took my stories. And I was in Somalia. I was in the north. There was a huge influx of refugees coming from a place called Togwa Chali across the border in from Ethiopia to Somalia. And I was reporting on it. And the Ethiopian government said I was totally lying. It wasn't true that the people loved to stay in Ethiopia and so on. So the Somali people told me to get a contra story and to go out through Djibouti into Ethiopia and see where these people were coming from. So I tried that. I went to Djibouti, but when I got to Djibouti, Djibouti is a little enclave, mostly speaking French, not English. They speak Somali also, they speak Afar, but I couldn't speak to them very well with my very, very little French. And I was standing on a street really feeling like a disaster because I couldn't find the Ethiopian embassy. This guy leans out of a bus and he says, in English, do you want help? I said, do I want help? Yeah, so he said, well, jump on the bus and we'll see after I'd finished this round of the bus trip. So this was Ismail, the man I married, but that was 1986. He helped me. He gave me a place to sleep in his family house. The embassy refused me and I had to go back again to Somalia. And 89, I decided I better go back and thank the family and thank him for all they'd done for me in 86. 3 years later, and he suggested we might get married. I thought, well, what's an absurd thing this is? Anyway, a month later, we were married. So there you go, very easy. And been married since, lived there since, dropped anything that was Western in me almost entirely, learnt to live without property. It's an interesting way of living, I tell you. It's very nice. It's a freedom now. But it's painful in the first place, but it's a freedom. So you don't have to own anything. And you don't expect anything. You don't plan to have anything. It's wonderful.
Is there also a sense of loss that goes with that?
No, not anymore. There was years ago, because years ago I lost all photos or contacts of my own family. We were in the civil war of Djibouti, which is not well known about, but there was a civil war from 1992 beginning of 96. Very bitterly fought civil war. I was trying to help those who were behind the lines and who was literally, again, I've been with so many malnourished people. These people were actually starving. They had no medicine, they had nothing. And I was walking with camel caravans all over Djibouti. And at the last of it, the French reconnaissance fighters came in to take away any territory that the people that I was assisting had got. And so I had to run through horrible desert land with stones all everywhere for over 12 hours with my child, Aisha. She was then nearly two on my back. To save my life with the French fighter planes overhead, the ISA army coming behind us. That was a run for literally for my life, yes.
I don't know if I'm allowed to ask this, but have there been times, you know, when you're fleeing an army or when your health is not good, when you've wanted that Western link or that out, that, you know, help that people get if they're Australian rather than Ethiopian?
From the beginning I learnt I couldn't have that. From the beginning. When I gave birth to my daughter, who's now 28, that was in Djibouti. I had a cesarean section. I was 3 hours on the operating table and they couldn't open up my clamped down uterus. The child was pronounced dead and I was dying. The death clothes were brought to wrap us up. So I knew how low I'd gone and I knew that I couldn't expect anything. I just had to accept. And that's the way it is. I've been bitten by a snake and almost died from the snake poison. What else? Well, years ago with the Eritreans, a bullet went straight through my hair. And so, and more recently had a bit of cerebral malaria. But when you're going to die, you're going to die. There is no stopping. And we, if I say we as Western people, we have no right over local people at all. If we take that right, it is so wrong. It is so, so wrong. So if they don't have the ability to take a helicopter out of the country and get medical help, well, I don't either. And that's the way I go. I don't take a different position to them ever. And I know I shouldn't.
How did you and your daughter survive that birth?
Well, quite honestly, I mean, I don't want to be... I know it was the hand of God, but in the end, she was born a little rat because I was working right up until the end, until I gave birth. I gave birth when I was 35 weeks pregnant. All the Lycor, all the fluid drained out, the uterus clamped down, and they simply couldn't get her out. 3 hours they struggled and tried until somebody slit my uterus straight up and tore her out and said, quickly, sew her up and get her out of this operating room. Yeah, so, I mean, it was... and then they pumped me full of antibiotics because they said that I, for sure, I was over-infected. And the little baby survived. She nearly died at 9 months old from pneumonia, very close. But we were living in Djibouti in extreme poverty. Government refused to pay me. I worked as a midwife in the obstetrics part of Beltier Hospital. They refused to pay us. So I couldn't treat her very well, as she should have been treated. But she got through. She got through.
Are you never afraid?
No. No. Fear is a useless thing. It's useless and it is self-indulgent. It really is. I stopped that quite a while ago. I did. And so I can run in the front line. I've had to be with war zone problems, with famine problems, with all sorts of problems. It doesn't matter. And in the end, death is going to come. You can't stop death, by the way. It's related to life. Huh? But here in Australia, they don't even know that. I mean, that's really amazing. But no, we could be snapped up tonight on the way back to visit my daughter anytime. It's possible. And we should respect that, utterly respect it. Yeah. And not be frightened of it either. If you have a Christian belief, well, you've got nothing to lose. Nothing at all. Not a scratch. Why do you protect yourself? Why? Life without risk is not life. It is simply not life.
This is Life and Faith from CPX, and you've probably heard enough already to convince you that Valerie Browning is a pretty remarkable person. She was awarded an Order of Australia back in 1999 for her work in promoting health and literacy in the Horn of Africa.
If you're a Life and Faith regular, then some of this may be ringing a bell. A few months back, we got to speak with Andrew Browning, who was for many years a missionary doctor in Ethiopia and Tanzania, among other places. That's also a really amazing and confronting conversation. Andrew describes his aunt as the black sheep of the family and said that she's given up more than anyone he knows.
Valerie's work among the Afar people has been an inspiration to Andrew And although she's seen a lot of change for the better, things are also getting worse for the Afar in a lot of ways.
Yeah, Valerie was in Australia, actually, partly to speak at a conference about the impact that climate change is having on her people. And she's not someone who pulls any punches in terms of laying blame or challenging our cushy Western lifestyles. She tends to be quite vocal about our politicians, for example, and about our own consumerism. She puts us all on the hook. I asked Valerie to explain a bit more first about what life is like for the Afar people.
Afar people are a very, very ancient people. So you can make them, if you look at their history, you can find among them small pyramids. They've been dug up by French people with the mummified body and the cup buried underneath this pyramid of rocks. They believe, the Afar people believe, that they were the slaves in ancient time of the Pharaon. So they go back that far. They've been herding this very, very, very arid land for that long. They have this enormous, amazing balance of ecology. So they understand how the environment can survive. They understand how to balance all things, not just environment, but social behavior, social norms, looking at economy. They have an egalitarian economy, so they are not capitalistic at all. So they help each other, they work together. It's a fantastic society. And I just am crying to think that this could be obliterated soon from the face of Earth. That in fact, the way the Afar live, they maybe have to be pushed to extinction because the rest of the world doesn't tolerate it. The rest of the world wants cash in hand, quick market, this, that, the other. And they, the world, especially this side of the world, is not prepared to see things as community value. They only see individual value, I think. And I think that that is tragically sad.
So tell me what's difficult for them and particularly what kind of problems they're facing at the moment.
Well, the problems they face are that nobody takes their hand off the Afar throat so that they can develop. They only started getting the benefit of education 15 years ago. They were illiterate. And about the same time, too, they started getting the benefit of maternal health. So they had the highest maternal mortality rate, the highest infant mortality rate in Ethiopia, and one of the highest in the world. Our organization, Afar Pastoralist Development Association, helped by Barbara May Foundation here, has been able to make some improvement in that. And the way we do things is a mobile basis with mobile health workers going house to house and helping mothers with antenatal care, postnatal care, and giving them delivery sets for clean deliveries, giving them access to referral as they need, as is needed. So Afar are on the edge of survival now. I think it's now 2008 that we first saw famine or starvation in the Afar people themselves. Before that, they had heaps of milk, drinking lots of milk and eating the meat of their animals. Today, the animals are too few for that to happen and for them to get good nutrition. So the animals have died of drought, starvation, the grass was too dry, no water, and so on. But more than that, their land has been taken. Their land has been impinged on by the forces of the Ethiopian government itself, taking the best grazing on the Awash River, putting up a sugarcane plantation so that they cannot do the dry season grazing they used to do. And also, Afar is very rich in all sorts of other resources because it's a volcanic area. So there is salt, a lot, there's potash, there's a lot of gold, and every overseas mining company is trying to get there. It's really horrid in that respect, but not to the benefit of the Afar.
Have you, you've seen things get worse in a lot of ways for your people. Have you also seen with the work you do things change for the better in some ways?
Indeed. Literacy is actually like, to use a jargon word, new life. If you're illiterate, you're looking back at your great-great-great-great-grandmother and saying, oh, she did like this, so I'm going to do like that. I'm going to do the same. Now, if you're literate, you can weigh up information and see what is good, see what is bad, take the best. So, for example, that nasty thing most people know about, female genital mutilation, is stopping. In the hand of the Afar, it's stopping, and they will stop it. Early marriage is now slowing down to the point where girls used to be married 13, 14, now they're married maybe average 16, 17, coming up to 18. We want to get 18 to 20. We'll probably get there fairly soon. No longer do they force girls to marry if they disagree. So that's stopped. And this is all recent time. We've stopped this in probably 10 years of work. And this is with training AFAR, AFAR women, AFAR men, to be community health workers, to be community awareness raisers, to be agents of change themselves. And that's happened. In rainwater harvesting, we've stopped a lot of thirst. We've worked to get market going through microfinance. And there's a lot of women now who are really helping their own family and extended family.
With all that you've seen and experienced, what have you learned about poverty, about its causes and what kind of perpetuates it?
That's probably all my life in the Horn of Africa is going to be my favourite question, because the West doesn't understand a thing about poverty. You think poverty is lack of food, lack of medicine, lack of money. This is not correct. Nobody ever wishes a bad life on themselves. Nobody does. So poverty is firstly defined by disempowerment, not the ability to help yourself. You're disempowered by what? You've been disenfranchised in your own land. You've been marginalised. You've been deliberately politically neglected. What has happened? Huh? So you don't choose that your wife dies in childbirth. You don't choose that, you know, you die of cerebral malaria because you haven't got a mosquito net, and that that's what would have prevented malaria. You don't choose that your children are never vaccinated and your children go blind by measles. That happens where I live. So this is poverty, but poverty is disempowerment. If you've got a radio and you can talk, if you've got a newspaper and you can write a letter to the editor, if you've got free speech, if you can do something, you shout. You say, I don't want that. I don't want to drink dirty water. Huh? But people in poverty who are isolated like the Afar people cannot. No, even if they did, nobody will listen to them. They'll just say, oh, illiterate people, no, thank you. We don't need to discuss with them. Huh? So this is what poverty is. It's the brutal, deliberate marginalisation of people. That's what poverty is. And the world better wake up to that. It is absolutely a human rights issue. Yeah, the consequence is hunger. The consequence is early death. The consequence is other things like can't go to school, no shoes on the feet, not proper shelter, all that is consequence. But in the end, there's a deliberate system to, I'm sorry, I'm a cynic, I think, but after all these years, there is no justice still. There is no justice, and even there is less justice today, because Australia, Canada, Germany, or the West, America, they're trying themselves to survive. To survive what? At their level of economic survival. Huh? Australia's scared that the economy could mean they can't buy a new iPod every year. I mean, really, what is going on here?
So what can you do in the face of that kind of poverty and that system?
Well, we can all do something. You, I, and your listeners together. We can do something through the Barbara May Foundation, which is a practical system where we can send out maternal health services into the rural, and help our hospital, the referral hospital we've got, to keep functioning, to help mothers to have safe birth, to help babies survive. We can also talk out. We shouldn't let... In this country, you elect your government. We actually, in inverted commas, elect our government, but the last election, the Prime Minister came in with 100%, so he was hardly elected, that guy. But anyway, that's a different situation. But here, you actually go through elections. You go through local elections and federal elections. The people you elected in, whoever you've got in now, you have to hold them accountable. You have to be accountable yourself. And even if the government will not act properly and not act with accountability, then the community must, the civil society must, the Christian church must, but not just the Christian church, the whole society must hold hands together. The planet belongs to everybody. It does.
In terms of your own work on a day-to-day basis among the AFA, how do you see the scale of the problems but get up each morning and serve?
Another big question. I do this because I'm not in charge. The person in charge of the planet is not Donald Trump either, by the way. Oh, that wretched Boris in Britain. Boris. Or Putin in Moscow. Forget those guys. In fact, whether you're going to believe it or not, God is in charge. If he wasn't in charge, I'd just dip out. Because I make so many foolish mistakes myself. I forget things, I muddle up things, I confuse things, and I make the situation worse if I deal alone. Okay? So I can face a famine, I can face cholera, which we had to fairly recently, with hundreds of people dying in the space of a week. I can face that knowing that the ultimate responsibility is God. What I've got to do is use all I've got, intellect perhaps, hands, legs, eyes, ears, everything's got to be in use. Any resources I've got to be in very accountable use. As a Christian, I find the enormous, enormous hand of God, and it's like, get up and do your work and stop being a little misery on the floor every single day. I mean, really. I mean, I have begged God, let me go home. Let me get out of here. I'm fed up. I'm tired. Each time, no way. You're not moving an inch. You get up and you do more. So I know I am enabled. I know I have got the ability to use a vision for the AFA that I can see into the how to get AFA out of problems of their environment, etc. I've been able to do that. So I have got gifts that are good for the AFA. It's not credit to me, because in the end, who am I? I'm just a nurse and a midwife who went there. Okay. I'm very unorthodox as far as a lot of what people would think in the Christian churches. But I think their orthodoxy is killing them. I'm a naughty person. So, for example, I have heaps of children, heaps. I gave birth to my daughter, but I counted before I left to come here. Under 7-year-olds, I think I have 11 in the house. That's a lot of under 7-year-olds, believe me. I mean, there's a couple of
I do believe
babies and all the rest. But we just fill up, kind of. The cooking pot is there, everything is there. So why are we not sharing? I think we have a better community life, and I see in the life of the Afar almost the life of the four Gospels. You know that. Where was Christ? Was he sitting in a very comfortable chair? Did he iron his clothes every day? Did he wear perfume? Did he do this? I don't think so. I really don't think so. You know? Did he eat muffins and whatever? No, I don't think so. I think he just, you know, literally almost rubbed his nose in the dirt. Almost. Yeah? Because he was with those who were the most neglected in the society. And he seemed to be having a good time, actually. I do think that. It's up to all of us in our own responsibility, in our own belief, to find out whether we're on the right path or not. But I try to do that. And to date, I'm pushed along, so.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart.
And me, Natasha Moore.
Now, if you found this conversation with Valerie Browning compelling and you want somewhere to go from here, a couple of suggestions. Go listen to our episode with her nephew, Andrew Browning. That came out back in May. The episode's called Missionary Doctor. And also, go and find out about the Barbara May Foundation and the work they're doing in maternal health care in Africa. You can support them at barbaramayfoundation.com. Next week on Life and Faith.
Sitting in that room with Ayatollah, he's looking at me, I'm looking at him. We're both a little uncomfortable with each other. And then the Ayatollah's young son walks in. He had several piercings and a couple of tattoos, and he didn't exactly look like the Ayatollah
didn't
type.
Fit the image.
He was, as we call it, he wasn't exactly following the pathway. His father looked a little bit discomforted, but he obviously loved his son. He talked to his son. And then when the son left, I leaned into the Ayatollah and I said, "So you got one too?" And he just comes back at me and goes, "How do you deal with it?"